Go for it.
And
today's the night of the
take
forest.
Take it off, take it off. Where that came from.
And on that, holy crap.
We're interviewing
Jesus,
tomorrow.
Man.
I just want to, I'm so proud and I'm so happy. Tomorrow, one of Kevin's things, we're interviewing Sumitra Chatterjee, who was the original Apu, for a phone interview. Yeah, I worked with him on a film that I did in India back in 2001, and I talked to him today, and he's going to do a phone interview for one of Kevin's pieces called Days and Nights in the Forest, and so I did the whole, like, voiceover thing a few days back. And then tomorrow is going to be the part two, is where Sumitra is going to do an interview from that 1969 Satyajit Ray film. So excited!
Wow.
And on that note,
welcome back.
Sorry.
It's on. Yeah. We hope you've had as many drinks as we had, because it's going to get ugly now.
We've found many amazing things during our break, such as a very cute girl who's seen and likes THX 1138, which is shocking.
Women are bed shaped.
And we should clarify, this is maybe part two of the
It is part two, so let's get that out.
No doubt. So, hi, the futurists. How's it going with the third-person references?
Yeah, I like the futurists. We leave him alone. Him or her. Hopefully, you know,
part
some
two,
probably him.
Part two of the season two premiere of Whitman vs.
So, two questions. In the midst of all this, like, Marvel comics, DC comics, like, action
movies. Hold on. You asked something earlier about films that deal with issues.
Yeah, but I got an even more pressing issue first. We'll get to that later.
Well, we already got to it.
Wait. I got a question, though. All these... we'll get to it next.
Okay, Kevin. Whatever.
Right. I want to know, is there a Wonder Woman movie in the works?
No.
No. Never.
Why not?
Because Hollywood hates women.
Wonder Woman!
It's only
all these action hero movies... Why is there no Wonder Woman?
Why is there
Of Catwoman. I don't know.
Why is there no movie with a woman in a bra and a onesie running around doing stuff? I don't know. Oh, wait. I do. Because no one wants to see it. And no one's willing to make it. And even if Joss Whedon did do something like that, it'd be retarded. Joss Whedon can only make short films.
Wow. The only way that a
Speaking
Wonder Woman film could
Dr.
work...
Speaking of, Dr. Harbaugh, best short of the summer.
The only way Wonder Woman could work is if Miley Cyrus played Wonder Woman. It's the only way it can work. It's the only audience that there is for that film, the only wide audience. It has to be produced by Disney, and it has to star Miley Cyrus as Wonder Woman. Period. It's the only way to work.
And that's true, because she comes from an island with no men, so she's absolutely safe.
Right. There's no chance of Wonder Woman being, you know, sexualized at all. It's got to come from Disney. It's got to be like next summer, otherwise it's never going to happen.
Alright, Angelina Jolie gonna be the next Catwoman?
Oh god, I hope so.
They remade the whole rumor on
she's already tried on that costume.
Wasn't Johnny Depp or Seymour Hoffman supposed to be the Riddler?
The Riddler, yeah.
I love how there's already casting rumors for a film that may not be made.
I'm really looking. It's like, okay, we're going into Dark Knight now, I guess. Cillian Murphy. I love you, Cillian Murphy. I you know, people were complaining
about his
cameo in Dark Knight. It's like, oh, no, more, please. I know you're coming back in three. You know, I really need more of you in my life. So.
And that guy that they took in, like, towards the end of that film, just like that Cillian lookalike who was there in the chair. That was one of the henchmen. It was kind of like off-putting. It's like, why not you Cillian there?
Okay, I want to give Stu the floor because he actually thought about the question I had in the session one, which is summer movies actually try to deal with issues and actually like succeed instead of just tacking it on for
Tropic Thunder.
What?
Okay.
Tropic Thunder.
Jesus, dude. Are you serious? It is one of the best Hollywood satires in decades. It's one of the best entertainment industry satires since Network. And Network is entertainment industry satire, not a news satire, not a pop culture satire. It basically relegates news to entertainment industry, and Tropic Thunder is one of the best Hollywood satires ever made. And I'll tell you what, Ben Stiller knew he was never going to be able to make What Makes Sammy Run, so he made this instead, and it is positively otherworldly. It's a magnificent film, and it really finds every Hollywood archetype and exploits it to, you know, a really rewarding degree. It's been very entertaining.
Jeremiah, what did you hear into someone else reaction. For a change? It's like, I will, my veins will pop out if I talk about it.
Jeremiah, look, whether you love it or hate it, it really tackles
neither.
Hollywood.
Nadeem, whatever you do, don't go...
It tackles, like,
please.
Popular stereotypes, like, oh, Maria Menounos, what a good sport she... I know I'm paraphrasing Glenn Kenny's review now, but it's so... I mean, there's... When we started watching it, it was one of those bullshit, like, college audience screenings a month ago, we didn't know what to expect, and there's, you know, those fake trailers are kind of brilliant,
yeah.
And we thought, wow, Ben Stiller's really angry, and then it turns out... Spencer's not really angry. He's tackling, like, really popular stereotypes of what happens. And they're not inaccurate, but they're not escapist by any means. And then the main advantage of an R rating is that he gets to make jokes about, like, severed heads and heroin. You know, that's really all he does with it.
He's too close to it.
Well, he is. And I have to confess, my main problem with this movie is that Ben Stiller and his fans, to be fair, of which I am not one, I think that's really funny when he says things in that strangled little voice that he has, which should automatically transform the most inane non-sequitur into the funniest line you've ever heard. I will call him Stickman, which I'm sure will be quoted in many fraternity houses across the country.
Well, look, if you have a problem with Ben Stiller, then, you know, that's separate from the issue of the satire, which is really spot on. The idea of an actor playing blackface to win an Oscar is really something that is and playing a retard to win an Oscar is absolutely... perfect. It's perfect.
Is Tropic Thunder telling the audience something that it doesn't know?
That's
telling us something that we haven't already made.
That's exactly
about.
What I thought.
Whether the audience knows it or not, it's actually revisiting those stereotypes and turning them on its head for a new era. Because yeah, the Oscar culture, the awards season culture, and the win at all costs culture is amplified now to a point where I don't know how much farther it can go in Hollywood. Really. I don't know how much farther the Oscar quest can go. And I think on those terms alone, Tropic Thunder is a really, really important film. Because it references I don't know. It's like it's beyond hunger. It's almost like kind of a it's beyond compulsion. It's like kind of a biological need to evolve for the sake of award season gratification. You know, and it's so much. I mean, like, for your consideration, something that came out a couple of years ago. It was like, oh, what a satire of, you know, awards culture. But really, I mean. You know, that doesn't touch Tropic Thunder, but it's not so clubbing you over your head because it's one thing to just like have archetypes based on a season, but it's another thing to actually, you know, make you feel really fucking uncomfortable the whole thing, you know, about a guy playing blackface and a guy playing a retard or whatever, Simple Jack. I mean, it's unsettling. It really is. You're kind of like, you know, squirming. I wasn't.
I mean, I don't know. I just found it. But I'm disconnected from whatever. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but
I'm disconnected. Then there's nothing. Then you're not. You can't be involved. You know, if you're not touched, then fuck it. You know, I was really touched by Tropic Thunder, not in an emotional, touchy, feely way, but in a way that really made me think about. Yeah, you know what? This is something that I think. Like, for example, I sat the screening I saw. I literally was sitting in front of Scott Rudin, okay, who the Les Grossman character is based on. And I was like peeking over my shoulder right now, and you could tell the guy was just like mortified. He had no fucking clue what was going on. He had no clue what hit him. And you know, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, where, you know, the Hollywood moguls can kind of, you know, take their lumps, and that's fine. But it's only when something like Tropic Thunder comes along that I think, oh well, and they'll forget about it in a couple weeks. Of course they will. But that's where our culture is. Not necessarily. That's not Tropic Thunder's fault. It's the way we just kind of, you know, we consume things and just shit them out and never think about them again. And Tropic Thunder's going to make like $30 million this weekend, and everyone will say, oh, what a failure. But it's not a failure. And if it loses money, fine. It really makes an important point. And this whole retard controversy is absurd. It's an important film. It really is.
I just have a very weird specific problem. I think Tom Cruise's profane rants are absolutely hilarious. But when he dances to the rap music, this is a very easy. It's about white people dancing to rap music,
yeah.
And how incongruous that contrast
yeah,
is.
That's boring.
And for me, and so Tropic Thunder is a 45-55 split between things that hit with the 55% things that don't, for me, just piss me off to know, because that's such a lazy joke. And the audience I saw it with, which was a college audience selected to be the target audience for it, found that to be by far the most hilarious thing. It's like, oh, look, there's a portly man with chest hair dancing to Ludacris, you know.
Yeah, but hey, what are the jokes that hit for you? What are the jokes that spoke
Tom
to
Cruise's profane monologues were terrific. Matthew McConaughey was long been an underexploited resource who has obviously cynically settled into these Kate Hudson, you know, backing roles. Is very good if you call upon him, and he is very good in this.
Is
he is, and he's very funny.
Yeah, he plays Ben Stiller's agent.
I think anytime McConaughey isn't falling back into that leading
man
role,
he's a funny motherfucker.
He is. I mean, McConaughey, a friend of mine, has this theory that McConaughey finds it hilarious. He's like, do you want me to take my shirt off and walk around the beach and get stoned? That's what I do anyway. That's what he does. Tropic Thunder, he first stretches all it's good. Jay Baruchel, who has long, you know, been overdue.
Agents, you know, like they had a CAA screening where the agents were absolutely appalled with Matthew McConaughey's performance. I mean, this stuff is really touching people. It is. It is getting under people's skin and influencing not only behavior, but it's influencing, you know, the way people think about themselves. It hit very close to home for a lot of people.
If you walk in, you're like, studio heads are venal. Agents are venal, actors are shallow, you know, crossover. It's just like,
do you really feel
it's
like actually influencing people?
No, that's what exactly what I just said, though. It's not influencing people. It's not going to influence people to change, but I think it is making people really uncomfortable in terms of this summer and films that affected people in a way that made them consider issues that are very personal to them. You know, those portrayed or depicted in Tropic Thunder regard that film as threatening, and that is something that can't be taken away from it. And you can say whatever you want about the humor, the jokes not working in half the film, but as far as certain segments of that population and how they regard and feel with themselves, it really did make a pretty significant impact, I think. And but again, they're going to forget about it tomorrow. They will, because that's how it is.
I mean,
that's how it is.
I haven't seen the film yet, but you're saying that it's going to be impactful upon the folks that are being carried
yes.
There.
Yeah. They don't look, because they know that people who are watching it don't give a flying fuck either way. They're just laughing at the jokes themselves.
Yeah.
But they know inside it, like, oh yeah, you know what? This is kind of a. This really is me, and they are.
Do you think they're that reflexive though? I mean, do you think that they're looking at themselves and saying, "Oh shit, they're imitating me," or they're saying, "Oh shit, they're imitating me," but what the fuck do I care?
Yeah,
because I control the fucking game anyhow.
Well, that's exactly it. That's why they're going to forget about it tomorrow, because they're going to go back to work and realize, like, you know, no, a creative artist agency, you can't really contend with that.
Like, you know, Entourage, the Ari character.
Right.
I mean, how many people was that based on? I'm sure plenty of people said, I'm Ari.
I'm telling
but
you
the same token, I'm making an ass, you know, fuck all y'all. It doesn't matter if I'm
two things. The CAA screening went over poorly with the Matthew McConaughey scenes. The Scott Rudin jokes went over poorly with Scott Rudin.
Okay. Wait, is that supposed to be Scott Rudin, or is that supposed to be Sumner Redstone?
It's not Sumner Redstone.
It's not Less Movies either, because that was the other thing I heard.
It's Scott Rudin.
It looks like
Scott Rudin. And he talks and behaves like Scott Rudin. And I was sitting in front of Scott Rudin at the screening, and that freaked him out. So I'm telling you, Hollywood is afraid of Tropic Thunder on a personal level, but next week it will be over and they'll forget about it. Okay? But that's what Sumner movies
are. So then ultimately it won't matter for anything.
It won't, but that's the point. The summer movie is like kind of, you know, it's very transitory.
And it'll be up to the critics and the fans, or, you know, the cult following to give it its longevity.
Longevity doesn't matter. Dark Knight will be forgotten too.
Let's just tell the Ty Burr story right now. Ty Burr has a blog, unbeknownst to me, and Ty Burr says he went to a friend's funeral, and all these teens found out that he's a film critic, and one by one, shame-faced, six or seven, they walk up. They all ask parents on the same question. Is The Dark Knight the most important film of our generation? compare it to The Godfather, and one says, well, you know what, it's like a generational moment. You've got JFK in 63, you've got The Challenger, and for us, it's The Dark Knight. Which and so the box office things have been coming out, like, Dark Knight probably won't beat Titanic, which some wisely pointed out that teenage girls are the most reliable audience, and Dark Knight's going to have that replay value. But it appears, and I don't understand why, I like Dark Knight a lot, but I don't think it's, like, an earth-shaking thing, but I don't understand anything.
Yeah, the thing is, Dark Knight is an intellectual film. It doesn't move you. There's nothing moving.
Apparently,
how is this a generational film?
Apparently, there are a whole bunch of 16-year-old boys who are shaken by The Dark Knight.
No, they're shaken because Keith Ledger's dead. That's the only reason. I mean, that is the driving force.
They carry that with them.
You're 16, that weighs heavier in your evaluation than when you get a little older. When you're 18 or 20 or 22 or 42, you look back on The Dark Knight and says, you know, did this speak to our generation?
They just see The Dark Knight, and it's like a thing for them, and it's a benchmark for them. Like The Godfather.
This is the generation that has never lost. And so now they lose an actor who's playing somewhat brilliantly the Joker, and they say, oh my God, this is the first time we've learned about loss. To quote De Niro and Cape Fear, you're going to learn about loss. But, I mean, it seems like it's a... Yes, if the young folks, they are down with it, that is probably... That's got a lot to do with it. They revisit it in only a couple years. Not when they mature much more and have families and responsible jobs or anything. Are they ever going to look back on that and say, yeah, shit, I remember going to see The Dark Knight. I saw it 15 times in the theater. And, man, that was, you know, that's kind of like forged how I've decided to live my life and raise my family. No one's going to say that. No one's going to say that. So it's huge for the moment. And as our culture is, the moment is bigger than it's ever fucking been.
But if you want
to, and so right now, the moment is going to make it the greatest thing ever. And then, in, you know, in this case, 4 or 5 weeks, it'll be, you know, something else will come up.
But if you want to see why kids are like responding to this so well, look at the aspect of the Joker. Oh, I'm for chaos, chaos, chaos. I do crazy things. I do whatever I want to do. To a 16-year-old kid, that's fucking awesome. That's like Neo going,
indeed,
I believe
indeed.
In nothing. I am the one.
I'm rebelling against my parents. Right?
They're like, oh, I'm going to rebel against you. I'm going to have Tiny Lister like pick up the bomb control device.
I do have to say, I was 13 when The Matrix came out, so I can perfectly recall how blown away was it. I don't know how people would respond to it now.
No, now people are like, what is this? Well, no, actually, I don't know. Look at The Matrix. Are you talking about if we didn't have The Matrix until now?
Now when I watch The Matrix, all I think is like, wow, Lawrence Fishburne talks a lot in between action sequences. But you didn't know that going in, so I do remember that.
Yeah,
but The Dark Knight is a better movie than The Matrix. I don't have any doubt in my mind about that, so it's not even the same thing.
The Matrix helped pave the way for this whole like pseudo-intellectual like action film genre, which is kind of what Dark Knight then plays into, when it's all, we're either doing order or chaos.
Yes.
Batman, you're
red pill or the blue pill.
Batman, you'll be red pill, Joker, blue pill. Aaron Eckhart, listen, we got bad news for you. You're going to be pretty prominent for the most part, but then we're going to replace half your face with CGI.
But Keith, how is that different than the X-Files, which you revere, which is, skepticism versus belief?
Because it's done more emotionally, resonantly, and convincingly, in my opinion.
Why?
Well, I agree. The resonance is there.
Because they've had 9 seasons of a television series in order to build it. Secondly, I think Duchovny and Anderson and Chris Carter are more serious about what they're doing, in the sense that they believe in the they believe in the pulpiness.
In the what?
In the pulpiness. They have faith in the pulpiness, and I'm not saying that they would come out and necessarily say that. But it's like, I think Nolan and company are about, let's aspire to high art.
instead of just, you know.
I have never seen someone jack a prominent comic book series and make it into their own kind of personal film and get away with it to the delight of the fanboys that Nolan has. Because it is, to me, not a Batman film at all. It's definitely the logical follow-up to The Prestige. But the fanboys have his back 100%, and he actually made his most personal film yet, as far as I'm concerned, on that budget level. I thought Batman Begins was bullshit, and it sort of conformed to the expectations of the genre within a limited kind of, like, oh, shaky cam, whatever. The Prestige is a limited budget film. Batman Begins is like tons of money, and it was like a remake of Memento. You know, and this is what I hate about Christopher Nolan. They say things like, spoiler, 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 spoiler. Sometimes truth isn't enough. That's a Chris Nolan thing that he says in like any movie that he would make, you know? And he came out on the other side. I don't know how he did it.
See, Batman Begins sort of redefines how you make a comic book movie.
Yeah, in a very, it's like, oh, we're shaking the camera to represent the moral ambiguity of the situation, and you have Liam Neeson spouting bullshit by the yard, you know, which is just atrocious.
But at the same time, Nolan,
it is what he's good at. Yeah,
but Nolan forced a very realistic hand at Batman. I mean, that's what most people are looking at.
He forces physical verisimilitude upon something, but when you stack it all up, to quote online cult hero Theo Panaitis, a city does not fall because, you know, Harvey Dent falls down. This is comic book psychology. It's an allegory that's masked because of physical verisimilitude. It's so awesome.
You fucking undergraduate.
Hey, I'm a graduate now. Thank you.
But if you look up to the films that...
I like the fucking movie. I think it's the best blockbuster I've seen since Spider-Man 2. I really
are you
it.
Gonna? Are you
absolutely.
Gonna, is it gonna affect
two
your
pieces
life?
Of shit in the
no, but most things don't. Right. I don't even, you know, like, even like, like Zodiac, which is like probably my second favorite movie of the decade. Zodiac does not affect my life.
But taking it away from this table and out into the general populace that sees, say, maybe a movie a week or a movie every month.
Every month, yeah.
Or something to that effect. And folks can remember, like, very important movies in their lives because movies are art. And, like, a story they read or a song they heard or something. They're going to think about it. Now, for Batman, say if it eclipses financially and ticket sales and all that across the globe, it eclipses Titanic, I still feel that Titanic will speak to more people than Batman will. As folks grow older and mature in life.
Sure, but I mean, like, so Titanic, I agree with you, it's universal because everybody relates to it, but everybody relates to the idea that, oh, I'm in love, and then I die. I mean, like, you know, it's like, these are, like, very primal things, and that's why Titanic is really everybody.
No, I'm not even talking, let's say, Dark Knight becomes the benchmark for what filmmaking is. It's not about your life. It's like, Dark Knight is what a movie should be. It announces its weightiness coming in, and then it entertains this, if you're me, anyway, it entertains the shit out of you. It entertains a lot of other people. It's not about your life. It's like, this is what filmmaking should do.
If Dark Knight is the best that films can do, fucking kill me now.
No, but I'm talking about...
Seriously,
people,
fucking kill me now.
It's not even that. It's just like, I would like for everyone to watch E.E., but that's not going
to
happen.
The want to kill you now.
Yeah, I know. They want to, so you know what? Come to my house and disembowel.
That's why you have four bodyguards everywhere you go.
Yeah, we're all sitting here right now.
I mean, seriously. Let's move on to maybe some shit.
Did you learn anything from that whole mess?
Yeah, don't mess with the internet. That's...
Yeah, like, was... I mean, about that generation or that constituency?
No, because I don't think it represents a generation. I think it only represents a generation if you buy into the whole fallacy that, you know, that a generation can be reduced to a group.
But what... Yeah, all right.
Yeah,
that,
I think
that
it buys into
like
a bunch
this.
Of cinema goers. And how it shows it is that art now... It
no, but
it's not long-lasting. It is very, very... it's shored down now to... There is so much product out there, and so much shit happens, that right now, this happens to be the biggest motherfucker out there, and then... Quite honestly, and say maybe not a month, maybe 2 months, as opposed to typically a week or two, when you see a better film than you saw a couple weeks back, then... You're gonna forget about the Batman.
There's always been product. There always will be product.
I want to reiterate this because I've said this before. Batman, The Dark Knight got so much more like serious consideration based on the populace and art house sides. I compared to Lars von Trier, and I absolutely believe it gets people uptight. It makes people nervous, at least because it got such a popular reaction. But I think The Dark
Knight
hits
the scariest thing about it.
I do believe that. I think that I think that Dogville, which I also think is intellectually bullshit and viscerally entertaining, it's the same fucking thing. It plays upon you viscerally, and I don't think it adds up to much. But I think the fact that Christopher Nolan made a movie that, like, really annoys people at some level actually, like, adds up to something.
The only thing I learned from the experience, Kevin, to answer your question, is that I have a much thinner skin than I anticipated.
Oh.
No, I'm serious. No. Because it affected me. Because the constant death threats and the constant insults that I read that a lot of people didn't read because they didn't let them go through affected me. It was worse than when I wrote the United 93 review. The only thing it taught me is that it is things about myself. Not really about the world. I don't buy it as sociology. I don't buy the Dark Knight as sociology. I think it's just, you know, what it taught me is that sometimes people can be cruel, but with the cruelty, there also is beauty in the world, too. I firmly believe that. I'm not going back on that. It's just like, you know, I was on the receiving end of a lot of shit that I don't think people are going to be able to really comprehend because I didn't let it go through into the public sphere.
But look, Keith, I think, you know, one of the really, sure, really cool things I've learned from, like, jumping on to Defamer is the whole, like, yeah, theory that the network in itself has never complain, never explain. You know, you basically have a great point of view,
right,
that drew an extraordinary reaction.
Yeah.
And as far as, you know, if you feel thin-skinned about it, I mean, just don't. I mean, it's absolutely, it's so, it's easy for me to say that, I know.
You know, you say just don't, but it's kind of like,
it seems like,
I told myself that,
yeah,
too.
It's,
I told myself that.
Extraordinary, though. It's so great.
The level of just, like, cruel, it was just like a regular day on 8 and Cool News that just kind of jumped over the house next door. That's like par for the course in 8 and Cool.
Yeah, but I told myself that, and I thought that I was doing okay, and the thing was that it affected me regardless, to the point that I made some really bad editorial decisions for a few writers I'm not going to mention because I don't want to bring it into a public sphere. But, you know, I basically brought that baggage with The Dark Knight into my editorial duties on some other pieces that I really should not have done. You know, and no, but I mean, it's upsetting to me. It's upsetting to me because I shouldn't have fucking done that. And the fact that this bullshit, and I know it's bullshit, a lot of it, affected me, is, you know, that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So it's probably made me stronger, but the thing is also that I firmly believe that it's going to get worse at some point. There's going to be a worse aspect of it because, you know, United 93 wasn't as bad as this when I wrote my review of that. This is worse. And I have a feeling as I progress through my career, there's going to be something even worse that's going to test me.
Of course there is, because that's the nature of our popular culture, is that everything has to either get better or worse. It has to accelerate. It has to really, you know, further dramatize itself.
And I know,
that's just something that we all kind of have to contend
with.
It's
weird that you bring up United 93, because the only two movies I've seen in the last 5 years that got, like, a response you could gauge in the theater were United 93 and Borat. And United 93 and Mixed Up Borat is kind of a shitty movie, but it's kind of funny. But those were the only two movies where I saw a crowd that was amped. And, like, at the end of United 93, it was dead silent, which you never have happened. Or you got, it was like a Richard Pryor concert. Like, people were, like, kind of freaking out. Like, they didn't know what. Those were socially significant movies, and they're also, like, not very interesting movies to me. Except as insofar they just get this thing out of you.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's a social phenomenon, and I don't know if I can classify Dark Knight alongside those.
I mean,
when I saw Dark Knight in a theater, people just, you know, shuffled out and did their thing.
And I mean, Kevin, though, I feel like that none of this experience, the reaction to me, and really The Dark Knight itself, and the two times I did see it, because I saw both the theatrical projection and the IMAX version, I don't think I really learned much of anything about people, you know, around me. I feel like, if anything, it was a purely self-revealing experience, and, you know, I don't really like what I saw about myself, to be honest, but... you know, that's the way it is.
Well, let's switch the...
Let me backtrack. Does anyone want to talk about The Strangers beside me, or is that just me? That's just me.
I'll talk about The Strangers.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
The Strangers is a really interesting... The Strangers was budgeted for $9 million. It made 50-something, whatever, which represents a significant success. It is a very bizarre movie in the sense that I can't imagine the screenplay being longer than 40 pages, because the dialogue is about 500 lines or less. It's basically, and what's weird, the scares in it, I think you might agree, are conventional scares. There's tension, loud music score, cut. The scares are fair. You know that it's going to happen.
So what stuck for you?
What stuck for me is that I was scared shitless the whole time, and yet I was incredibly bored at the same time. Because at the one time, I'm easy to scare in a theater. You know, if you're going to like have a loud music cue, I'll jump.
Are they conventional scares then?
They are conventional scares.
They're very conventional scares.
At the same time, there's nothing happening in the movie. It's just like, you know, arm comes out, curtain gets pulled back, face comes at you. You know, something about the strangers connected with people. I don't know, the strangers is deliberately cryptic in a way that makes me think that the guy who wrote it didn't have anything behind it. He just made it
cryptic.
He didn't
write it. That's the only thing. It's a remake.
Grady propounded that theory that it's a remake of Them, the French horror
Grady's
movie
right.
that no one saw.
It's a remake of Them.
What?
It's a remake of a French horror film by the same name called Them.
My favorite thing about The Strangers is that...
Them and The Strangers have the exact same problem.
The Strangers is hilarious because when the killers come into the house, they put on a Joanna Newsom record. I think Joanna Newsom is torture, so that's really funny. But aside from that, like, I don't really know what's going on with this movie.
All it is like, well, I get from point A to point B without a thing jumping out at me and, like, grabbing me.
It's like this genre fixation on efficiency. The Strangers is extremely efficient.
No, The Strangers is very efficient, but it actually makes an argument for a movie that's, like, an hour long. It's like, okay, you can do that to me for a half hour or 45 minutes, but The Strangers goes on and on, and after a while, I'm hip to its game, and I'm kind of like, all right, you're just going to, like, you know, jump out and scare me, and I got tired of it. I stopped being scared.
I've never had this where I was scared. I was terrified the whole time, but I was also really bored. Like, I kind of wanted to leave. You know, like, I know I'm going to jump in my seat.
Yeah.
And I don't discount Mr. Bertino's talent because he's onto something. But it's just, like, you know, at the end they have that exchange about, like, why did it happen? Because you were there. It's just like, I don't think you even thought about what happened before that. It's just like, it's deliberately cryptic. I don't understand.
Sure.
For me, The Strangers, when you see the budget versus gross phenomenon,
yeah.
It is kind of like Halloween. It is kind of phenomenal.
Sure, fair enough.
But a movie with very minimal advertising made it out there and obviously, like fucked with some people.
And it was kind of programmed with, like, something like Speed Racer, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, same
time. It was easy to kick Speed Racer's ass, apparently. So.
Okay, so let's talk about Speed Racer, though. What the fuck?
You liked it, too, right?
I
thought the editing in Speed Racer, the actual editing and the exposition in terms of having foreground, middle ground, background.
Sheer efficiency of exposition, Speed Racer is unchallenged.
It was unbelievable. And it was really revolutionary.
If this clarifies, I think for me, Speed Racer is the same movie as Hellboy 2, because besides the efficiency of exposition, which is obviously different from Hellboy 2, it's moment-to-moment stimulation. And I found Speed Racer moment-to-moment stimulation. I didn't check my watch once, which is really rare.
No, I didn't either, but I didn't like Speed Racer. You know?
And I could really understand why an audience that doesn't just wants to see a blockbuster would hate Speed Racer, because it goes off on about 30 tangents, including, like, the Vikings. You know, it cuts to a shot of the Vikings, these things. Like, nothing really happens in that movie that's relevant to the plot. The tour of the car factory is basically Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in about 2.5 minutes. I mean, it's terrific.
Right.
But I completely understand why someone would hate it, because, you know, it's not relevant. And it spells out its anti-corporate theme with such heavy-handedness that...
But see, I hate it for an entirely different reason.
Oh, yes. Okay, go.
Well, seriously, I think it is a perfect adaptation of the anime. And that's great. At the same time, the anime has nothing going for it. It has no plot. It has nothing whatsoever.
And that
goes into what the movie is, because there's no plot. It's speed.
It has no plot.
Grow up and race cars. Okay, speed, you're racing a car. I am racing a car.
Are you shitting me? I've been championing the last days for years. You think no plot is going to bother me? And it's not the same thing.
Oh, wait.
But, like,
on record, we're comparing last days to Speed Racer.
No, not exactly, but, like... Someone compared it. It's a, you know, someone called it, like, Mac D'Angelo and his Las Vegas nuclear review. Said it's classic plus. It's an avant-garde film. If you want to watch Speed Racer for the dramatic plot and exposition,
you
will be doomed. There is no emotional arc in that movie.
But that's what
not their intention, though. I don't know.
I gave up on our tourist attempts a long time ago.
But that whole capitalist barons. I mean, you know, you've got the guy in Speed Racer, Timothy Spall's character. That's not his name. Well, you got the anti-capitalist theme there, but you've also got guys like Bruce Wayne and Tony Stark.
who are major capitalist figures who are kind of heroic in a way. And so it's very interesting to see them playing as if they're conflicted and they're kind of going through some weird shit. But they're actually dynamic characters as opposed to the guy in Speed Racer. Just like
Speed Racer may be the least emotionally dynamic movie of the summer. Yeah.
But I mean, the whole capitalist baron theme actually got really interesting play in other films. And then and in Speed Racer, it shows up, you know, more, you know, technically. It's like he's edited in a way that, you know, like, you know, for profile views. And he only sneers, you know, a couple scenes. For the most part, though, it's like all the Wachowskis kind of design. He doesn't actually get a chance to act.
I find that thrilling. I mean, to go back to what John was saying, you know, Speed Racer is kind of thrilling because it takes the anime aesthetic very literally to a live-action degree. It plays it out to its logical conclusion.
I don't know if that even works in live-action anymore. I mean,
maybe not, but because
it's very pretty. I mean, it's probably the best visuals you'll see.
That's right.
Because
I've been watching, like, last night, ladies and gentlemen, I saw The Long Shots directed by Fred Durst for review, okay? So, like, I will admit that there's a common charge level against, like, day-to-day hacks that we're addicted to novelty, and that may not be untrue. And I am addicted to novelty. But I can... Speed Racer is nothing but novelty, and the question is, if you think that's worth it... Speed Racer is an absolute waste of your time. If you want to get involved in the story, the emotional... If you want to get involved in anything... If you want to see Speed Racer for minute-to-minute simulation, Speed Racer makes it worth your time. I saw it digitally projected just to make sure, because it is one of those new movies that... See, in 35, it is kind of a loss, because the level of detail is all CGI anyway, so you might as well see projected in crystal clear pixels. Yeah, Speed Racer has nothing to offer if you want to see it as a movie.
What really annoys me is the fact that, and I'm sorry I'm going on the anime tangent, that's the only thing I have left to mean, but anime has gone further and further, become more and more cinematic. What Speed Racer is showing is showing 1960s animation in full, bright colors, when during a fight sequence someone moves punches someone else and zoom out and zoom in and another punch. Zoom out, zoom in.
It's really hilarious, though. I mean, that level of commitment to an arcane aesthetic.
I just find it bizarre. No one follows that anymore.
This is why I'm out of touch. I just don't give a shit anymore. I mean, I'm very entertained by the fact that the Wachowskis would sabotage their career on a very literally just like such a literal-minded interpretation of something that no one, including me, actually gives a shit about. Like the original Speed Racer series, I agree, it's bullshit. I mean, it's nonsense. But they took it to a whole new level.
What about films budgeted under $10 million? What came out the summer? Independent.
Meet Dave. Meet Dave.
Besides The Strangers?
That was not under $10 million.
Okay, not grossed under $10 million. It was made for $10 million.
Strangers cost all the money.
The Romance of Estrie and Celadon by Eric Romero, which I'm glad I finally get to talk about. What are you going side for?
I'm thinking what was under $10 million.
Okay. Well, summer's a bad time for under $10 million.
Yeah, I just hate to say the word independent films because
to be honest, I was amazed X-Files was $30 million total. That's practically Val Lewton prices nowadays, so, you know.
Did anyone see Man on Wire?
No.
I think Man on Wire might be the best one of the summer. It's fantastic.
That's what I hear.
I actually interviewed, what's his name, Petit?
Philip Petit.
I interviewed him when he did a book review about 4 years ago. You released a book and moving up to interesting dude. Very interesting dude.
Yeah, we
I
had
didn't
a,
see the movie.
No, it's extraordinary. Yeah, it's an extraordinary film.
We had a piece on Man on Wire by Godfrey Cheshire at the house next door where he admitted to walking out of it because of the Michael Nyman music being recycled. And
there would be reenactments. I mean, like, oh, my God.
How does that affect the crew?
But James Marsh actually wrote in and commented. So, I mean, you know.
I mean, we're
got an interesting dialogue.
No one saw it, I guess, but Stu, did. Were you that familiar with Greenaway's music that it distracted you from the film?
No, and I think anyone who like insists that the reenactments or the recycled music are some sort of detriment to the film's craft. I think anyone who has that, you know, that kind of that the perception of it really just is kind of stupid. Really, I mean, you've got to give a filmmaker a little more credit than that. You know,
yeah.
we recycle things all the time.
I'm going to say at this point that I fully support Godfrey Cheshire's piece that I published on the site. Just wanted to clarify that. Move on.
No. I mean, Cheshire's entitled to that. That's fine. He can have that. I'm just and Cheshire now is a filmmaker. I mean, I think that's his mandate though. Now he's got his own, you know, filmmaking thing going on, and he can afford as a filmmaker to say, well, I made a documentary, and I can say that, well, everything I did was original. So shame on you, James Marsh. Well,
I don't see it that way.
Yeah. Well, I think you know. It depends on what the filmmaker's intentions were, and you have to take it on, you know, that account, and you have to take it on its own terms. And I think James Marsh, you know, I'm telling you, James Marsh's intentions were something more dramatic, more kind of, you know, creatively narrative. He was trying different things, much like a lot of the narrative, more straightforward narrative filmmakers of the summer were trying. He was trying different things with documentary, and as such, I think he really made strides in the form. And I think Men on Wire is a really important film.
Have we mentioned Backhead while I was gone?
No.
Because I want to say that Backhead, before we do that, Preston
was going to say something.
Yeah, but it is interesting, you know, as a filmmaker, someone that makes those choices as far as music or editing, what have you. I mean, I can't completely subscribe to Godfrey's point that it ruined the film for him and he had to walk out. I mean, because he has seen more films than, you know, the average viewer or anyone at the table, probably.
Yeah.
But in the same token, it is an interesting conundrum from a creative standpoint. So why would you use pre-existing music that is in... It's almost like, why would you use, like, 2001 music? Or
well,
why would you use...
Well, that's exactly
free music.
Well,
but use that exclusively. And
Preston,
not use additional music.
And Preston, I should say that James Marsh goes into that on his comments on the thread.
And I think that speaks well for the house, because that's the way the film... I read those. The filmmaker came on, and he defended himself.
And as I recall... Part of it was A, money, and being able to, not really being able to hire a composer, per se.
But
I believe it, because he said that he got some original composition from a friend of his who gave it to him for free. But that was just for a few brief scenes. He also said he used the Michael Nyman music because Philip often practiced to it. And so it was kind of like it gave an emotional weight, as I recall,
and again,
to his
thing.
I'm
speaking way out of school because I haven't seen the film, and that to me was the most like justifying reason. It was because Petit listened to that music while he was doing his thing, and evidently that's not in the documentary. If it were in the documentary and if it was a reason for it, then it would make a lot more sense. As opposed to A Guy on the Wire, and then there's some very familiar music. It's only a familiar music to, you know, a half a percent of somebody. So everyone else that watches the documentary who is not familiar with Greenaway is going to be fine with it.
But so much of There Will Be Blood soundtrack, for example, the Johnny Greenwood score was recycled from stuff that was on the BBC.
It was from a BBC. I mean, that had no relevance to 99.5% of the American population.
What's the fucking difference? You know, I mean, if you recycle, I play a Stone Cold Pilots song over a movie, you know, I mean, we recycle pop songs all the time. And so, really, I don't understand what the complaint is. I don't understand what the grievance is. Okay, so there's a documentary filmmaker who is recycling film from a Greenaway, or recycling music from a Greenaway film. I don't get the complaint. I don't get the problem.
Yeah.
Because we recycle elements of culture all the time in our films. I mean, no one is really... I mean, Brian De Palma, for example, was... celebrated for revising and reinterpreting the
Brian De Palma actually took one of the ballsiest moves of all time when in Femme Fatale he composed a sound-alike for Bolero like 2 beats off.
So what's the difference? I mean, we reinvent and recreate these things all the time. We steal, you know? And if we steal actually no from you, we steal
that from music. Four times. Thank you.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
You know, and I think Godfrey's the reason Godfrey wrote that at all is because he was a filmmaker now. And he says, you know what? I can do this. I'm not a critic anymore necessarily straightforward. I'm a filmmaker and I can say, well, you know, I did it this way. Marsh did it another way. He's lazy.
I don't agree with Godfrey saying he's lazy. I don't agree with that at all. And I don't agree with the fact that now that Godfrey's made a film, he's automatically a filmmaker, so that, you know, everything is, you know, now I'm the expert. I don't agree with either of those two things. But I like that, being a filmmaker myself, and having to choose the music, and having to take some office music. Basically, because I'm so fucking piss poor, I have to get friends to make the music. I just find it fascinating, and I think Godfrey raises a decent point.
Yeah,
and the fact that
I think it brings up a situational point. You know,
it's a situational point. Yeah. And again, it really doesn't affect 99% of the audience.
It's really too bad y'all haven't seen the film. It's great.
Can we take it with
us? The one thing I will just add, and again, not having seen it, but one thing I would like to just say is that seemingly it was never mentioned in the film that Petit loves Michael Nyman's music. And if that would have been added there, then hello, none of this would have been an issue.
Alright, so what else? What else is great?
We're going to talk about Backhead and take a break.
Backhead. Actually, no, let's take a break and we'll come back.
So this is the end of part two.
Jesus. Yes.
If you've listened this far, I mean, what the fuck is wrong with you? I mean,
we're going to post it over 3 separate days.
If you've
days.
Listened this take far, come on down, because we're still talking.
Yeah, we're still here.
to steal a page from the Medium Results.
We might even buy you one. We're the fucking film geeks in the corner.
I'll buy you a picture.
If you actually have listened this far...
And you're the futurist, then male or female, please.
You can call John Lickman at 202-320-3929. Tell him what you think. I'll likely either be smashed or watching anime. And that's it.
Cut that fucking
We'll be back.
Shit.